everyone. I'm Deborah Owens, and welcome to Wealthy Radio. Does investing in stocks seem out of reach for you? Our first guest teaches high school students how to excel in the stock market. And if students can, so can you. And are you a woman who settles for what she is given? And are you determined to get what you deserve? Our second guest is on a mission to help women get their fair share of startup capital and says, if you don't ask, you won't get. We want to hear from you tonight, so our phone lines are open. Join the conversation at 410-319-8888. You can also send a tweet to @DeborahOwens with the hashtag WealthyRadioChat or leave a message on the Deborah Owens Facebook page. All that and more in just a moment.
Up. You can be anything in the world, and God we trust, an architect, doctor, maybe an actress, but nothing comes.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wealthy Radio. I'm Deborah Owens. Well, the truth is, folks, it's not like it used to be. The days of a lifetime employment and a pension at the end of your term no longer exist. And in fact, whether you like it or not, you have to know what's going on in the financial markets. You have to choose and make choices in your retirement plans. You have to practice asset allocation and putting your investments in different baskets. And so the question I have to ask you is, when did you learn about investing? I mean, did you learn about it in elementary school? Did you learn about it in middle school? Did you learn about it in high school? Well, 90% of the time that I ask adults that question, the answer is no. And so I'm really excited because there is a gentleman that's coming on my program who is out to change that. And his name is Dr. Alan Cox, and he's managing director of the Maryland Coalition for Financial Literacy and the stock market game coordinator. And he spent over 45 years in the field of education. And Dr. Cox, it's a pleasure to have you on Wealthy Radio this evening.
Hi, Deborah. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing really well. Man, you've been at this for a while. You really have. So talk to our listeners just a little bit about, how did you find this love for financial literacy?
Well, Deborah, it goes back to 1985, teaching at High Point High School in Prince George's County. And I was getting ready to do the stock market crash, Great Depression, New Deal era of history. And somebody, I don't even remember who now, told me, why don't you try the stock market game? So I thought, well, okay, stock market game, if my kids can understand why the market crashed, and maybe they can understand a little bit more about investing, a little bit more about why they need to invest. And so I tried the stock market game, and Deborah, in those days, it was much different than the way we do it now. Actually had a scan sheet with a number 2 pencil, and the students would bubble in the stock that they wanted to buy, and they would bubble in how many shares they wanted, and they'd give it back to me, the teacher. And believe it or not, I actually put it into the U.S. mailbox. It would go to Washington College in Chestertown. We had a scanner there. It would be scanned, and then it would be put back in the U.S. mail to me. I'd give it back to my kids 2 weeks later.
Oh, my.
That's the way we used to do it.
Things changed.
Yeah, we've come a long way since then. It's now done completely online. Teams of students throughout the state of Maryland are playing the stock market game. We had more than 3,000 teams of students playing the stock market game in 5 different sessions over the school year last year. About 10,000 students. And the way it works, ever, is each team gets $100,000 in virtual cash, and the object is to try to make that portfolio grow as much as you can over the course of the time that the game is offered. And to be honest with you, I really don't like the idea of calling it a game. It's a simulation.
Yeah.
And for me, it's all about planting the seed in kids' minds that they need to learn how to save and they need to learn how to invest in today's world.
Well,
if you ask yourself just 2 questions, Deborah, One, would you recommend that kids today count on Social Security as their only form of retirement income?
Well, I wouldn't suggest that anybody do that, even if you're nearing retirement, because for most people, it's not enough to live on. But I guess the question I ask, and what I love about the fact that you have this this long perspective, and I'm sure going into it, you were basically looking at it as a teaching methodology. But is there anything since you've been teaching this game that has surprised you about what people are learning?
Well, I tell you, it's never been a kid problem. Kids embrace this idea of, you know, looking at stocks, researching companies, finding out about companies, trying to figure out if companies are going to do well in the future or maybe not so well in the future. It's always been in the teacher's mind that they need to know about everything everything about saving and investing in the stock market and all the ins and outs before they can teach it. And one of the first things I have to overcome with teachers is I tell them all, you don't have to know about the stock market in order to pull this off with your kids, because you're going to tell your kids, hey, kids, I don't know what's going to happen tomorrow in the stock market. I don't know what's going to happen next week in the stock market or next month or next year, but we're all going to try and find it out together.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, though. I'm so glad you say that, because I feel like for so many adults that the older you get, the more risk averse you become.
Yeah.
And so that adults really have some impediments to really embracing risk, right? Because that it's that uncertainty, not knowing what something's going to be in the future, that causes all the fear. And I'll be honest with you. I didn't even realize how much fear people had about investing until I actually started coaching people. And, you know, when they would, you know, I have comments around, you know, I've just paralyzed in my fear. You know, I never. And part of it, though, Dr. Cox, is that no one, since they didn't learn like in elementary school, or it's not something their family did, it's completely foreign. So as a result, people feel a lot of shame around even revealing that they don't know, just like you're having with the teachers.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the hurdles I have to get over with teachers. But, you know, what happens also is the teachers who have done this a long time along with me, they become very, very good investors themselves, because they've learned right along with the kids, you know, what kinds of strategies work and what kinds of strategies don't work. And, you know, the other question I was going to ask you is, do you think our kids are going to have an employer in the future, be it a public or a private employer, who's going to offer them a monthly income for life if they put in enough years in the organization?
No, and in fact, I'm writing a book right now about that same topic, and it's really the fact that this is not our parents' or grandparents' economy, and I really liken it to going back to the future. Back to the future meaning, you know, there was a time when there was no corporate structure where you actually went someplace and they gave you a paycheck. You really had to be more entrepreneurial, whether you were a locksmith or, you know, or whether you were a seamstress. And we're really, our economy is really shifting back into that type of dynamism, right? Where that people really have to have an entrepreneurial mindset.
Yeah, they really do. And they have to get over the idea that the government is going to take care of them for life.
Or that a corporation's going to take care of them for life either.
Exactly. And you know, I sometimes wonder if this idea of somebody who is 65 years old, who's put in, you know, 35 or 40 years with an organization, and then gets a monthly pension for life, whether that was really a 20th century phenomenon, never to be repeated again. If you think about what people did before 1900, what happened before 1900? What happened to people that got too old to work? Well, many of them died.
Exactly.
A lot of them moved in with family and friends. A lot of them.
Well, I also believe that. Well, yeah, I mean, life expectancy in 1930 was 65, and I think the biggest risk that people have, that we all have now, is longevity risk, right? It's not dying too soon now, it's living too long. And I also think that we're going to see, even within our own pension system, whether it be public or private, the actuarial tables were not designed for people to live beyond 100 or, you know, 30 years beyond 65. And so I don't believe the assets really are going to be there to pay these pensions. And so what you're seeing is many companies actually kind of divesting of it and putting that risk on financial services companies.
Absolutely. And you know, if somebody today who's 60 or 65 years old, and a good chance if they're healthy at 65, they're going to live to be 90.
That's right.
Now they're long-term investors. They're long-time savers. They still have 30 years for their money to grow and continue to provide an income for them.
Well, you know what's interesting, though? Even when you look at traditional financial planning concepts that tell people, you know, once they retire, that it's got to be preservation of capital and not, you know, that you can't afford to take risk. Well, that was true when you were going to maybe die at 70 or 75. But to your point, you do have 20 years beyond. And the only way that you're going to be able to keep up with the cost of living is to be a long-term investor, maybe not 100%, but you're going to have some exposure in the markets.
Yeah, and everyone needs, you know, emergency money. Everyone needs some cash for things that they're going to need that they haven't counted on having to spend for today. But, you know, for folks who are looking for income in retirement, and all the risk that they're willing to take is to put their money into a bank savings account or a money market or a CD, you have to look at those returns, you know, that rate of return on those investments. And you have to ask yourself, is that rate of return going to cover inflation in my future?
Well, no, especially because that income, you're going to have to pay taxes on it many times, too. I want to invite our listeners, though, if you're just joining us, my conversation in this first half is with Dr. Alan Cox. He is managing director of the Maryland Council of financial economic literacy, or talk to us a little bit about your organization as well.
Yeah, it's the Maryland Council on Economic Education, and we're headquartered at Towson University, and our main mission is to make sure that teachers have everything that they need, knowledge, skills, and materials, information about how better to teach economics and personal finance.
Gotcha. Let me let our listeners know, though, if you've got a question for Dr. Alan Cox, he is also coordinator for the stock market game. And I know there are a lot of teachers who listen to this program. And if you want to know how to bring something like the stock market game to your school, we'd love to hear from you. 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. It's critical that not only our kids learn, but also that our educators learn about the stock market so they aren't fearful. So if you've got a question for Dr. Alan Cox, or perhaps you've participated in the stock market game in the past, we'd absolutely love to hear from you. Give us a call at 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. And, okay, so my question while we're waiting on callers is, so how do you, if you're a teacher listening to this program, Dr. Cox, how do you get someone to bring it to your school?
Okay, well, the Stock Market Game is actually a national program. It's in all 50 states, and there's a national headquarters in New York City in the Financial District. And the website is real simple. It's just www.stockmarketgame, all one string, stockmarketgame.org. And when you go to that website, and you can even do it on your smartphone or tablet, you can register your teams for whatever session during the school year best fits into your curriculum. And the students can also use their smartphones and tablets to make transactions using the stockmarketgame.org app. And, you know, the thing about the stock market game that I like most is that it gets kids looking at the economy. It gets kids looking at current events, because now those things are affecting their portfolio. So I think it makes kids much more aware of what's going on. And, for example, we have a new president, a new administration. Those things have affected the stock market. We have the Federal Reserve that's trying to limit the portfolio that they have established since the Great Recession that started in 2008. That's going to affect the stock market. That's going to affect their portfolio. They have to pay attention to international events. They have to pay attention to what corporations are doing. And that gives them a whole new sense of understanding about what the world is all about. And I want to say something else about risk, since you brought it up earlier.
Absolutely.
You know, if you take a look at today's inflation rate, which is right about 2%, I think it's like 1.9%, and you have money in a passbook saving account at a bank, and that's fine if that's emergency money that you may need later on, but if that's your only form of savings, and you're getting 0.1% interest, that's 0.1% interest, that's not only not keeping up with inflation, you're actually losing spending power every single year you have a dollar in that account. And once again, it's perfectly okay to have money in a savings account for emergency spending, but to have that as something you're going to count on as a return on investment later, you're actually losing money doing that.
Yeah, it is true. But you know what? It's interesting the way you're framing this, Dr. Cox, and I love the way that you say you're losing buying power, right? And that money is not compounding at enough of a rate to even keep up with inflation. And that's the whole point, right? So, you know, what I like to ask people is, what did a loaf of bread cost 10 years ago? About $1.50. And now you go in the store and it's $4. And so that is what you are conveying about that purchasing power. So that if your money hasn't grown and things continue to cost more, how can you keep up?
Exactly. And, you know, today's with index funds and mutual funds that are more market-based broadly than they have been before, there's really no reason for people to try and pick individual stocks unless they really feel comfortable doing that. Trying to pick individual stocks that perform in a given time period is really difficult for anybody, and most people are not very good at that. But if you take a broad-based, you know, total market, S&P 500, diversify into foreign, some foreign stocks, having some bonds in your portfolio, having small cap, large cap, mid cap stocks in your portfolio, and diversifying your money across those various sectors, that's really pretty safe investing.
Yes, but you know, but Dr. Cox, so I don't want to say devil's advocate, or let me just act as if I'm one of these people who's risk averse. And the first question they have is, okay, that sounds good, Dr. Cox, but what about 2008 and 2009 when I was in the stock market and I saw my investments go down by more? No, they don't say I saw it go down. They say I lost 50% of my portfolio. What's your response to that?
Well, hopefully they didn't get out.
Most people did.
If they stayed with it, they've more than made up that loss and almost doubled their money for right now. Because market is a very resilient thing. We've gone through wars. We've gone through attacks from, you know, foreign countries. We've gone through all kinds of things that would cause the market to drop, for investors to be unwilling to make investments in the country. But we've lived through all those things. And the market, if you look at the long-term trend, the stock market has returned something about 9%, if you look at the S&P 500, since 1926. So if you're a long-term investor and you have a diversified portfolio, chances are that portfolio is going to perform pretty well for you, much better than you're going to do anyplace else with any other kind of investment.
Absolutely. These phones are really quiet, though. The phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. My conversation is with Dr. Alan Cox, and we're talking about his experience teaching students how to invest in the stock market. We'd love to hear from you this evening. 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. I guess I should check our social media feeds as well, because you can send a tweet to @DeborahOwens, or you can also post your questions on our Facebook page. If you're listening, I'd love to hear from someone who maybe feels that way, that they were in the stock market, and that, you know, what do you do if the market goes down? Again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. Because my other thought, too, when you say emergency money, I also think the other way to frame that, Dr. Cox, is it's like any money that you're going to need within the next 5 years should not have stock market exposure. So those are kind of the funds that you would have in your funds. But those that you can allow, you know, that have over a 5-year time frame, that you can allow the market to go up and down, it just makes sense. But these phone lines are lit up. I'm not going to let you respond until afterwards. Let's go right to the phone lines. Let's see. It is Tiana?
Tina,
hi. You got a question for us?
Well, you mentioned if you want to call in if they participate in a similar program.
Yeah.
When I was in high, it wasn't quite, I guess, the stock market program that you have. But when I was a senior in high school, I was taking an economics class, and our teacher had us all pick a stock, and we put it on the board. You know, you can see at the end of the class, you see who won the most or who lost the most. And so that kind of exposed me, but what really exposed me to the stock market, my older sister, she worked with Federal Reserve Bank, and she had given them a book called, I think, like, Money Dynamics of the 1980s by Benita Van Caspel.
Yes!
And that's what really exposed me, the book. And I guess then my older sister, you know, you kind of look up to them, you listen to them, and, you know, and so eventually when the opportunity, I was too young to buy it. I knew my mother wouldn't sign off on it, because I was like, I just turned 17. But, you know, I kind of forgot about it for a while, but eventually, like when I was 19, I bought my first stock. And but it was, I think, the exposure that my sister gave me from the book. But the class was nice, too, because that was after she had given me the book, and I read the book. And so that's kind of how I got it.
And you took action, but that is so awesome, Dr. Cox, mm-hmm. that she got that exposure, because that's key, right?
It's planting the seed. That's what it's all about. And, you know, kids that are given stock get really mm-hmm. interested in having stock and looking at the company and following the stock and what it's doing. I tell parents sometimes that if you want to do something nice for your kids, instead of buying them Nike shoes, buy them Nike stock.
That's right.
I'm thinking about doing that as a second. I had a nephew to graduate from high school this year, and we just gave him some money, but I was thinking he'd come down to visit, and I was thinking I want to give him a second gift, and I don't know whether to get him a stock or a stock he can identify with, maybe, if I find something that's of interest to him.
Yeah, you know, a couple of things. I want to give you some apps that you can. There's one that is called Robinhood.
Robinhood.
Yeah, and it allows you to invest with as little as $10 and learn about investing. And, you know, you can, I'm trying to think of the Loyal3.com. They're another company that basically have convinced brands to use gifts of stock as a brand loyalty. So just those two ideas I have for you. But thanks so much for sharing that this evening.
Okay, great. Okay.
Thanks so much,
okay.
Tina.
Okay, you're welcome.
Okay, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. Let's go to our next caller. Karen, you're on the air. A question for us?
Hi. I am wondering how to consider investing if I have a health savings account with investment options.
I didn't realize health savings accounts had investment options. Are you aware of that, Dr. Cox?
Yes, I am. Mm-hmm.
Okay. How would you respond to her then?
Well, once again, I think considering a diversified portfolio for that money that you have that you're not spending on healthcare in any given year is the way to go with it. And, you know, you made a great point about the 5-year kind of window to take a look at.
Right.
You're trying to do some investing. You know, obviously, if you're, let's say you're planning for a wedding next year, Mm-hmm. Well, that money should not be in the stock market.
That's right.
If you're planning on some travel in the next couple years, maybe a special occasion, 25th wedding anniversary that you're going to take 2 years from now, that money should not be in the stock market. But if you're looking at 20 years down the road for retirement, or to do any kind of long-term planning for an infant that might need a college fund, for example, it's for sure that money is going to grow much, much more likely in investments that include the stock market than not.
Absolutely. And so that really is my thought. Typically in a health savings account, those funds would be used for more immediate needs. And I really feel like you need to have a time frame or a time horizon of 5 years or beyond before you consider investing in stocks. Karen, I hope that was helpful.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking of using it as a planning for medical costs as I get older. I don't plan to touch it now. I don't have to use it right now.
Got it. Well, I mean, again, if you can afford to take the approach of where you know you're not going to need that money within 5 years, and you could weather out any volatility, because the market will get volatile. Just like it's up, it does go down. That would really be the suggestion that I would give.
Okay, thank you so much.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Cox, we're right up to the half hour. Please let our folks know how they can get involved with the stock market game.
Okay, the website is stockmarketgame.org. And the Maryland Council on Economic Education, our telephone number, if I may, is 410-704-2137.
Excellent. Dr. Cox, a pleasure as always. Thanks so much for your dedication to financial literacy. I got to tell you, 30 years, that's saying a lot.
Well, appreciate it. I'll come on your show anytime.
Okay, excellent. All right, folks, don't go anywhere. In our next half, if you're a woman who has a business and wants to learn how to get access to capital, you're not going to want to miss our next guest. Don't go anywhere, folks. We'll be right back.
If we try,
oh, yes we can, I know we can, yes we can.
Great gosh, you're mighty.
Oh, yes we can, I know we can.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome back to the second half of Wealthy Radio. Are you a woman who is interested in getting funding for her business? If that's you, you're in the right place in this second half. Here's the deal. So many of us, we ask and we settle. And our next guest is on a mission to really close the extreme funding and confidence gap that exists for women-led businesses. She is the founder and CEO of iFundWomen, a crowdfunding platform for women-led startups and small businesses. Karen is a pioneer in the digital media space and was an early Google employee who spent 10 years leading various monetization teams. She spent 3 years as general manager of AOL, Original Video, and was responsible for business strategy and strategic partnerships. She's all about helping women get the funding they need to get their businesses off the ground. And Karen, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on Wealthy Radio this evening.
Deborah, hello. I feel like I'm talking to a friend. I am so honored to be on your show and talk about all things getting women's businesses funded, especially in the Baltimore and Maryland area.
Absolutely. So, yeah, I'm excited. You know, I wrote my newsletter today, and I talked about this kind of quest that I had been on. You know, I felt like I was the perfect candidate. You know, I'm a former financial executive, author of 3 books, platform on TV and radio, joined this women's incubator and made my pitch deck, started, you know, down the road of pitching different places. And I mean, nothing. I got nothing. Yeah. I got naysayers and no, 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 no. And what I learned, though, was that I was having the same kind of experience that so many women were, because only 2.7% of women-led businesses get venture capital. Why? Let's start there. Why is that?
Oh, Deborah, how long is this segment? there is a huge funding gap for female entrepreneurs. And yeah, the latest stat is it's about 2.5% of venture goes to women and 0.2% go to women of color. And we are all in this together.
Yes.
And so we're all starting from pretty much nothing. Why that is, really, my simple stock answer is that, you know, white men have all the money and the power in this world, and people are tribalistic in nature. And no matter who you are, you tend to trust people that look like you and are from places that you're from and that have worked with you. And if one group is holding all the money and the decision-making power, and they're put in front of 2 equal entrepreneurs, one who is a white guy and one who is a woman or a woman of color, instinctively, who are they going to go with?
Well, you know, it's interesting.
That's the simple answer.
Yeah, that is the simple answer.
The reality is it's unconscious and conscious biases that have been pervasive and, frankly, getting worse in this country and this world for, you know, many centuries. And what's so exciting, though, is now is the time that we are making massive change. And now is the time that people are realizing, like, the data is coming out. Thank goodness for places like the Kauffman Institute and UC Berkeley and all of the very credible, reputable organizations that are putting out this research highlighting this massive problem. And companies like iFundWomen are coming forward doing something about it.
Well,
so
you know,
I feel like we're at actually a very exciting time.
It is an exciting time. And I just saw the study that was done that showed that women do really well on crowdfunding platforms. So that's really, really exciting. You know, I wanted to tell you this story, though. So, I'm recanting this same story to someone else about, the struggle that this path that I've been on, this quest to get funding. And, you know, they looked at me and they said, well, you know, maybe you need to go and get a co-founder who's white and 28 years old and wears a hoodie. And, you know, although I was dumbfounded by that, I thought, you know, there is some truth in that, Karen. There is some truth in that. What are your thoughts?
There is. I mean, listen, you're going to get to know me, and I am brutally honest. I'm always the person that's going to give you the real honest truth. And a lot of people may not like that, probably especially my publicist. But listen, I don't think that you should go out and get a white co-founder.
I was offended by it. I'm going to tell you.
You weren't offended by it.
No, I was. I thought, well,
yeah,
that's
kind of,
so what problem does that solve, right?
Like, that doesn't solve any problem other than potentially getting you noticed by all of the VCs who are mostly white and some brown guys. And maybe, you know, it's not a solution. Listen, it's not a solution. But women have to get creative and scrappier to get our businesses funded. I mean, that's just the reality. That's the reality. And I am not suggesting that you go and do that. I think that's not the right thing to do. I think you have to be true to yourself and true to your business. And, you know, when women start businesses, we start them with our brains and our heart and our passions. And the reason we perform better, not only in crowdfunding, but actually when we start our businesses, the data shows that our revenues outperform those of our male counterparts. The reason why women are more successful entrepreneurs is because we have thought through all of the scenarios and all of the strategy to the nth degree before we jump in the pool, many times to the detriment of the of getting to market quickly. But women are so strategic and so thoughtful in their approach to business that that's why we outperform. So I would say the answer is not going and getting a white male co-founder. The answer is really staying true to your business and starting from a place of where all businesses should start, which is, okay, I've got an idea. I need to prove out my idea, my MVP, my pilot, my prototype. And we believe that crowdfunding for cash is the best first stop on the funding journey for any entrepreneur, right? Because what happens is, and I'll just take sort of the women's vantage point, what happens is when women want to start a business, you've got sort of two buckets of entrepreneurs. You've got the 1% bucket that are coming out of big corporations, they're coming out of business school, you know, they have, you know, maybe 2 degrees, and they've been brainwashed, and I put myself in that bucket. We have been brainwashed into thinking that we need to go out and raise an equity round as our first step, and that is a bad piece of advice. That's not what we should do. Okay, so that's that one bucket. Let's put that to the side for a second. Then there's the other bucket of entrepreneurs, which is the 99%, the everyday American female entrepreneur, which is, by the way, the fastest growing segment by a factor of 5 of all entrepreneurs, women of color leading the charge.
Yes.
In starting businesses more than any other group. And so you've got everyday American women that are starting businesses. And what do they do to look for funding? They look to their local bank for a loan. They look to federal grants, you know, state grants, or they look to friends and family for loans. And that's also not the right way to start a business. The first thing you should do when you have a business idea that you've been ruminating on, you've bought your URL, you really believe in this, this is a passion, you've always wanted to do it, the first thing to do is do a crowdfunding raise for cash and start with that. So raise around whether it's $5,000 or $50,000, just enough to get you started, to make your first line, your prototype, your pilot. Get some market testing, get some feedback, get some early customers, and then iterate. Because the reality is, Deborah, 92% of startups fail.
Right.
And that's perfectly fine. You're talking to a second-time founder. I have a failed startup on my first, you know, on my docket. And that's, I like talking about my failed startup because I learned all the lessons and I learned all the things not to do, which carried me into my second startup, which is markedly, you know, more successful so far. So, but what is important and what the message I want women to hear is, do not go into debt starting your business.
Amen.
Do not take a loan out to start your business.
Well, not only loans, but that's what I find even in the local economic development space is that they're giving out these loans. And really, if you don't get out of the gate, that is another level of stress that
yes.
you don't need when you're trying to get sales on the books, right?
That's right.
And so my other question to you, and that's great advice. I really believe it's great advice. If you don't have to go into debt, don't do it. However,
don't do it. And you shouldn't do it because you don't know if your business is going to make it. And crowdfunding for cash is a great way to start. It's cash.
If that's true, though, yeah. But I mean, if that is true, then the other point that you made, Karen, was that minimal viable product, right? That MVP. And so, women who are, and again, let me invite folks on the phone lines. If you're just joining us, we'd love for you to join this conversation. My guest is Karen Khan. She is the founder of iFundWomen.com. Really, really excited because she's launching in Baltimore. We're going to talk a little bit about that this evening. But if you're a business owner and you're trying to figure out funding, you want to call in and get some insight. The phone number to call, 410-319-8888. That's 410-319-8888. Or you can also send a tweet to @DeborahOwens or go to our Facebook page, the Deborah Owens page, and post your question. I wanted to go back to that minimal viable product. So talk to us a little bit about why that is so important.
So this is a mistake that I made in my first startup. So all the things I'm telling you are straight from the horse's mouth, so to speak, meaning like I went through and did all the things wrong, and I feel like it's my civic duty to just pay the information forward, which is that a minimum viable product is the least expensive, the cheapest version of your product that you can put out to get some market testing. Because what I did and what you should not do in my first product was I spent a couple of years, frankly, and a lot of money building this software that I thought had to be perfect. And perfect was the enemy of done, right? So like I came out of Google and YouTube, big tech companies and AOL, brainwashed into thinking that if I put out a technology product, it had to be perfect. And that was just absolutely wrong. And so I should have put out an MVP, which is a working prototype that wasn't as pretty as I wanted it to be and just had the basic features that I wanted people to test, and put it out and gotten some market feedback. That's an MVP. You do a beta test, you see, you get a small group of people, maybe a couple hundred people, that you can find through your crowdfunding campaign. That's the other great thing about crowdfunding, is you get your early customers, your early beta testers, to test your product and to see, like, they'll let you know what, I don't love this, I don't use this. You know, you can see from the analytics what people are using and what they're not using. And then from there, you can take the money that you've made from your crowdfunding campaign and iterate and put that into V2 of the product. So whether you're doing, a yoga line, we have a new campaign that's doing a line of yoga pants for pregnant women, which is really cool. I haven't seen that before, which I think is fabulous. So they are raising money to do their first sort of prototype line where they're going to make a couple hundred, a run of a couple hundred. That's the way to do it. They'll put the product out in the market. The people that come on their iFund Women campaign will be the first to pre-order the product at a discount. They'll get the product and they'll give them feedback, how it fit, how it washed, all of those things. And then that company, which is called Tribe Maternity, and you can actually find them on iFund Women right now. If you're pregnant and listening to this and do yoga or work out, you should go buy a pair. But you'll give them feedback. And that's the way to do it. And that's what I didn't do in my first startup, which is, it's so gratifying to be able to give that advice to entrepreneurs to say, do it this way.
Oh, I love it. Now, I'm going to say something fairly provocative. Okay. I have a woman coach, right? Business coach. And one of the things that frightened her about my business model on the coaching side of it was that I was focused on women, because she said to me, she said, well, Deb, I'm going to tell you, and this may seem harsh, but sometimes women don't want to invest in themselves. What are your thoughts about that? And, from a crowdfunding platform, one of the points you were making was this this gulf, right, of just in terms of funding gap. Will women support women on these crowdfunding platforms?
So that's such a great question. So I think it's sort of a two-parter.
Okay.
So I'll take the second part first. So
okay.
The great thing about iFund Women is that half of the backers are men. So there are feminist men out there that want to support women's businesses, and we encourage all of the women entrepreneurs on the platform to have rewards for guys. So, for example, I'll take Tribe Maternity as another example.
Okay.
They have a guy's reward, like a dude t-shirt, which basically is saying, like, we want men to support us and support our vision, and we know you're not going to buy these pants unless you buy them for your, your partner who's pregnant. We always coach women to have a guy reward because men want to help. There are millions of male feminists out there that absolutely know that their wife, their sister, their partner, their friend, their neighbor is an entrepreneur, and they want to support them. And so we really, really market iFund Women to men, just in terms of like getting involved in the mission.
Yes.
iFund Women Inc.'s investors are men who believe in the mission. So there's a lot of people that really, really believe in closing the funding gap for women, and it's not just women. So I want to give a huge shout out to the feminist men who are on iFund Women.
Woo-hoo!
And shopping for their wives and girlfriends or shopping for themselves and buying the dude rewards. So that's awesome. So that, I'll put the guys to the side for a second. But for women investing in themselves, Deborah, you're exactly right. women are reticent to invest in themselves. And we see that with our coaching services and our video production services. Now, iFundWomen.com, any legitimate business can come on. They can start a campaign, DIY it if they have their video, and if they have their, you know, their campaign and their rewards built out, they can do it themselves. There is no additional cost for them to do it. So, like, that's just number one, besides for the platform fees, which are 5%. Same as Kickstarter, same as Indiegogo, you know, to keep the lights on.
Right.
But we also offer expert video production capabilities for those who need a professional video. We offer it for as little as $500, which is nothing for a crowdfunding video. If you Google crowdfunding videos, you're going to see prices anywhere from $3,000 to $5,000. We are making them professionally in our studio in New York for $500 for women because we want them to get started. And we're finding even at that price point, which is not a lot, women are reticent to invest in themselves. And so we talk a lot. We coach everybody that comes on the platform. Everybody gets a free 20-minute coaching call where we are going to tell them exactly how to run their campaign. I'm going to talk as fast as I'm talking now, and so are our coaches, and we're going to let you absorb everything you can in 20 minutes for free. We are going to encourage you, if you do not have a video, to have one professionally made, whether it's with us or with somebody locally, we don't care. And what we're finding is women are reticent to invest in themselves, and that's a problem. If you can't invest $500 in a professional marketing video for your business, you need to check yourself before you wreck yourself.
Because yeah,
you need to have that video.
Absolutely. So so the other thing that I found interesting about your platform. So, I mean, and by the way, if you're just joining us, my conversation on Wealthy Radio this evening is with Karen Khanna. If you want to follow along with this conversation, go to the website iFundWomen.com. If you're thinking of starting a business, if you know a friend who needs capital to start a business, you need to go to that website and take a look at the different types of ideas and approaches that women are taking to just build businesses. But more importantly, support these women-owned businesses. I mean, sometimes I just want to pull my hair out because mm-hmm. I feel like what women don't understand is you get what you pay for, right? So it's like
That's right.
Ignorance is expensive. So while you're trying to run around and figure out how to use some Vimeo platform or editing or Final Cut or while you're doing that, time is money. And so the whole
That's right.
point is you want to hire somebody else's strengths, right? Like you're good at what you do. But you're not good at making a video. And the whole point of it is to get up on that platform so that you can let other people help you. But oftentimes, yeah. what we don't recognize as women is that financial freedom ain't free. Let me just be that frank, okay?
Yep.
So the money has to flow, and in order for it to flow, you've got to invest so that you can reciprocate. But we so many of our hands are closed, and not only is it strangling our own businesses, but it's strangling women as a whole. And so we have to get beyond just being an observer or a critic and actually put some skin in the game. Again, the phone lines are open, 410-319-8888. My conversation is with Karen Khan of iFundWomen.com. So let's talk about, the other thing I love about your program is first you were online. Now you're starting these cohorts in different cities. Why are you doing that?
So that's a great question. We believe very deeply in rallying communities together to help our own. People inherently care about their local communities. They care about jobs. And we are literally putting people together, putting entrepreneurs together, creating a community of women that are encouraging each other, coaching each other, tapping into local feminists and people that want to help the local female economy. And we are crowdfunding together. And it's been really, really magical. So we piloted it in Nashville. with Mayor Megan Berry, who was the first female mayor of Nashville, and we had a cohort of 50. And what we did was we got everybody together at the Entrepreneur Center in Nashville in a real space. We created this live crowdfunding marketplace where we invited all 50 entrepreneurs. We gave them a table. They brought their demos, and we invited over 200 local business people, angel investors, you know, feminists who wanted to contribute to the campaigns, and everybody walked around with their mobile phones from table to table and funded multiple campaigns.
I love
it. The idea, it was wonderful. And we're doing the same in Baltimore at Beta City on September 28th, which we're so, so excited about. So the idea is that, you know, women who are starting businesses, starting a business is very isolating. As you know, you're usually in your home or you're at a co-working space if you're lucky, but it's very isolating and lonely, and you have nobody to bounce ideas off of or interact with. So we've created this community on Slack, which has hundreds of entrepreneurs, and we have different channels for different cities. And the Nashville cohort, they now, all these 50 entrepreneurs know each other. They're actually hiring each other to for different services.
Well, see, that's what I think is so important is, it, you know, I was listening to Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn and PayPal fame, whatever, and he's got this great podcast out called Masters of Scale. And that's one of the things that he talks about. The reason that Silicon Valley is so successful is because of that ecosystem, right?
That's
and,
right.
you know, people getting access to resources and information and network intelligence and all of that. And I really feel like that is what's missing in, like, the female entrepreneurial economy is that kind of camaraderie. But not only camaraderie, but also commitment and investment in seeing other women succeed.
There's no question. And first of all, I love Reid Hoffman's podcast, Masters of Scale, as well. And the producer is a woman, which is great. So you can feel good about supporting the female creative economy. June Cohen is the producer, and she's excellent. So, that's exactly right. I mean, we're trying to create a community of not only women who are helping each other get funded, but also a community of expertise to tap into. So, you know, I think one thing that we would love are obviously more female engineers in the community, because that's the secret sauce of Silicon Valley, right? You can go out there if you want to start a tech company. If you go in the Valley,
you can
around you at the cafe at Phil's Coffee, there's a million, you know, engineers and product people and developers that you can tap into. And that's sort of one of the things that the rest of the world has to catch up on.
But yes, and that was the other secret sauce, because on one of those podcasts, he talked about a young woman right here in Baltimore and at Johns Hopkins, and that's what Johns Hopkins, and that's what she was able to do, is really pull on that community of the university for that intelligence, right? You know, why they're in school,
and it
not being so costly. So that was my other question to you was, if let's say you are doing something in technology, you just around and you need a prototype or you need that kind of competency, what advice would you give women who are in the tech side of the startup industry?
Oh, that's a hard one, Deborah, because I have myself, you know, tried some different tactics, you know, whether it's freelancers overseas, and have had not great experiences.
Right.
I would say, network, I think personal referrals are the best. So we, at iFundWomen were referred to local developers here in New York City where we are based.
Yes.
And we have worked with them for 3 years. I can go down to their office, and I can sit with them, and I can, you know, they are part of our team. We are now at the point where we have raised a seed round, and we are actually bringing our technology in-house. And so we've gone through the phases, right? The first prototype phase was, okay, we have to look to outsource, and we looked in our local community. So I think if I had one piece of advice for entrepreneurs who are, you know, not developers but are building software or are building an app, there are pods of developers in each of our cities. I mean, Baltimore, absolutely, and Maryland, you've got a whole tech scene down there. And there
so
what,
we just have to get out and we have to network and we have to do those meetups
and talk to people. Exactly. And meetups. Meetups are like the unsung heroes of connecting with people. I tell you.
I concur.
Yep. But I would keep it. I would try to do as much of the work locally in your community with a human that you can meet with. And that's not to say that there aren't great resources abroad that are less expensive. But to your original point, I think you get what you pay for. And I think nothing beats an in-person connection.
Excellent. I think that's right. You know, we're just about up to the hour. I do want you to, so you're launching in Baltimore. Tell our listeners how they can get involved.
Yes. Hello, listeners in Baltimore and Maryland at large. We are launching iFund Women Maryland. We are so proud to do so with our partners, Betamore and PNC. So the way you get involved is simply go to ifundwomen.com. In our top nav, you will see, and Deborah, maybe we can sort of tweet out this information or
absolutely
tweet out the URLs.
Yes.
In our top nav, you will see things to know. Hover over that and go to local cohorts. So again, ifundwomen.com, go to the top nav and under things to know, you'll click local cohorts and you will see all the places we are involved. So we have Newark, Raleigh-Durham, Nashville, and Maryland. You click on Maryland, and you will see all the information you need for both entrepreneurs who want to apply and for generous humans who want to contribute to the Maryland Accelerator Pool. And so for the entrepreneurs listening to this, don't wait. Apply now. Like, get over that confidence gap. We will help you. We have coaches standing by to help you get your campaign up and running. We will help you with your video. The time is now to do it, especially if you're in Baltimore listening to this.
Do it. I'm going to be there.
I'm
launching. And the other thing is I want people listening to this show to come out and support these women. So it's about participation. It's about learning. It's about engaging. But most of all, it's about investing and paying it forward to others. Karen Kahn, thanks so much for coming on Wealthy Radio this evening.
Deborah, thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate it.
My pleasure. I look forward to seeing you at your launch, and I'll be launching too. Okay, folks, thanks so much, Karen. That was Karen Kahn at ifundwomen.com. If you want to get involved in her launch here locally for crowdfunding, go to her website, ifundwomen.com. That's going to do it for me this evening, folks. A shout out to Essence Mosley, producer. Great show tonight. Even though you're not in studio, Andre Melton has been hanging out on the boards as usual. That's going to do it for me this evening, folks. If you want more information, go to my website, deborahowens.com. Sign up for the free newsletter and learn about everything that we have going on in the Wealthy You world. But don't go anywhere, folks. Coming up next, Fiesta Musicale. All that and more right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community.